The topic before me this morning that I've has been developing for some time, it's not maybe a topic that I would exactly tend to want to pick or be easy. In fact, I thought about it this week. Over the years, I stood behind a pulpit or lectern or whatever you want to call it multiple times in front of groups in the settings that I grew up in. You were expected from about the age of 16, if you were a church member, you are going to be speaking in church. You're going to be sharing Bible studies. You're going to be up front. And so I did that in spite of where my heart was at. But I would have avoided a topic like this. I would have done everything I can to avoid this topic. But it's something that's been developing on my mind for some time. There's a phrase that's been running around in my head for the last couple months, and I don't know where it came from, possibly from our cell group and studying through Ecclesiastes, and possibly from the title of a book by Don Richardson that's called Eternity in Their Hearts. How many of you read that book? I'm just curious. There's definitely some of you. Maybe some of you look like you're not quite sure. You maybe did. You don't remember. It is a good book. I would recommend it. But I went looking for that phrase, kept ringing in my mind the last quite a while, eternity in their hearts. And so I went looking for it in the Bible, and I was disappointed I didn't find it in my King James. But I'd invite you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 this morning. Donovan, can I get you to bring my water? Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time, also, thank you. Also, he has set the world in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. He hath set the world in their heart. Now, the word world there comes from what I found in the Strong's, comes from the Hebrew word olam. Don't know if that's the right way to pronounce it. But it means, according to Strong's, the definition that fit here, properly concealed, that is vanishing point, generally time out of mind, that is eternity. And most translations, if not all, that I looked up, say he hath put eternity in their hearts. I love the King James. I enjoy it a lot. I see the problems of switching away from it, but I would venture to say that this is one place where they got it wrong, where the word that might fit better would be eternity. He has put eternity in their hearts. Some time ago, I was loading stuff at No Frills in Stratford. I get there probably every 2 weeks to pick up supplies. And there's a young man there that I've gotten to know a little bit. I would say possibly, I would guess, some of you that are good at reading people would probably have figured out that maybe he comes from a troubled home. There's things about him that are just, you can tell there's something going on. Socially, maybe he's a little different. And so I've gotten to know him. Some days I got a little frustrated at the speed that he helped me, but it was okay. And recently I was working with him, loading my pickup, and I asked him, I said, "Do you ever think about what happens after we die?" "Oh, all the time," he said. And we talked a bit more, and it turns out He opened up after a bit and he said, "I fear death tremendously." He said, "I'm constantly thinking about death." He said, "I have epilepsy and I've fallen twice. The last time I fell, I asked my mom afterwards and I was only a few inches away from the nightstand. My head was when I came down." He said, "I can hardly go up and down stairs anymore. I'm so scared that what if I fall and die?" I shared with him this verse. I said, God has put eternity in your heart. And that's a blessing. That's a privilege. That's something to be thankful for, eternity in your heart. God is calling out to you. There's something more. There's something more after this. This is not it. I was, when we were out in New Brunswick for that wedding, Matt's wedding a few months ago, after the wedding we went to Canadian Tire to get the oil changed in our car. And I was sitting there in the waiting room, and there was a, in the little, waiting room there by the service, and there was a fellow there, and I got chatting with him, and I asked him the same question. I said, do you ever think about, or what do you think happens after death? And guess what? I got a similar reply. He fears it. He has a fear of death. And I also got to share with him. The people around us, and it kind of spoke to me, and I don't want to sound like I go around and share constantly. I don't. To my shame, I don't as much as I should. The people around us have eternity in their hearts. They're hungering for something more. They are longing for something that will satisfy. There's an awareness that there's more. And we are well aware of that today. But if you are going to have eternity and you're going to explain eternity, there is really only one way you can do that, and that is if you think about time. I have a question for you this morning. Simple question. What is time? What is your definition of time? Yes, brother. A short dot in eternity. All right, I like that. Anybody else want to be enough, brave enough to answer that? What would you say? What is time? Yes, brother. Opportunity given. I like that. To do good or bad, opportunity given. Back there, yes, brother. Something you can't buy, for sure. One of the properties of time. Think about that a bit, maybe this week. Webster says, a non-spatial continuum that is measured in terms of events which succeed one another from past through present to future. And Wikipedia adds to that a little bit. Says, time is the continuous progression of existence that occurs in an apparently irreversible succession from the past through the present and into the future. And I like what he added there, the apparently irreversible succession from the past through the present and into the future. Time is maybe hard for us in a sense to grasp, but if you notice this hourglass, I don't know if you can see it here. I put it up here on the way up. It's supposed to be a one-hour hourglass. I timed it twice. When you buy things on Amazon, you buy the cheapest. It lasts about 58 and a half minutes. But that sand is running through that hourglass. And without outside force, without a force outside of itself, it cannot reverse itself. There is no way that that thing can physically jump up and turn the other way around. It cannot speed up. It cannot slow down. It cannot stop itself. It cannot pay to have more sand added. You aren't going to hear that thing halfway through the service. Hey, 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 I bid $5 million on another 5 minutes. It can't do it. It cannot redo parts of it. In other words, it cannot take sand from the bottom and replace it with some more sand and say, hey, I'm going to take some of this sand, I'm going to put it on top, and I'm going to redo parts of that progression. It simply is running through there at a steady flow, like the clock that keeps ticking, ticking, ticking. We can't stop it. There are people that stop time for themselves. And that's very unfortunate. That's taking God's plan into their own hands. But beyond that, there is nothing you can do with time. It runs at a steady pace. Turn with me to James chapter 4. Hebrews, James, it's in here. There we go. James chapter 4, there's a very astonishing question, and this is what I want to concentrate on this morning, this question in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14. Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? What is your life? It doesn't say, what is life? Because if it said, what is life, we couldn't explain it. We wouldn't be able to answer the question. It doesn't say, what is our life? Then we could answer it altogether. It says, what is your life? Now, there may be different age groups and different things that different ways you might answer that question. A child might ask the question, where do I come from? And as parents, we better be ready to answer that question. Maybe at the age you're at right now, you would say, why am I here? Or possibly as you get older, you start to ask the question, where do I go from here? What is your life? Somewhat of a difficult, maybe, and a personal question. You might say, my life is a failure. My life is a success. My life is a disappointment. My life has been a wonderful experience. My life has been a difficult journey. My life is hell on earth. I hope not for any of you here. My life is heaven on earth. There are different ways that you could answer that question. What is your life? Maybe it depends on who's being asked the question. If I ask a worldly-minded man, what is the life of you? He may say it's failure. It's a failure. That man, he works hard, but he has little to show for it. He drives a wreck of a vehicle. He lives in a shack. But you ask that man's elder, and he says he's the most dedicated brother we have among us. He gives more than you would think he does to many causes. He's willing to be used. You ask the man himself, and he may say, my life is nothing without Christ. My life revolves around Christ. Or you ask one sister to explain another, and she observes that this sister is so caring and giving. She sacrifices for others again and again. She listens well. She's able to nurture other people. But if you ask her neighbor, she said, oh, she's a poor woman who lives under the authority of a man. She has potential, but it was never realized because she never went to college. She never had a career. If you ask her, she may tell you that she feels so inadequate for her work. She is sad. She runs out of time sometimes to make fancy meals for her family. She struggles to have enough time to be with God alone. But she loves the Lord supremely and is so grateful for the joy that she has in Him. You see, life is much about our perspective of it, isn't it? What is your life? What is time? These are questions that are good for us to stop and consider. Different cultures view time in a different form. I found this interesting. I wouldn't have been aware of this. But us as English-speaking people, Brother Jake said a dot, but we tend to experience time or think of time in a linear fashion. So we think of time past on the timeline, and we think of time future on the timeline, and we are a dot on that timeline. Now, if you expand that thought further, we're not even a dot. I don't know how you would, and I see Jake is nodding, he agrees. You can't really define it in light of eternity, right? But we think of time as linear. If you talk to a Mandarin-speaking person, they tend to think of time as vertical, up and down. So you've got past, let me see if I get it right. Up is past and down is future. And when I read that, I thought, well, we need to go out and witness to them so that they turn it around, so that down is past and up is future. But apparently they tend to think of it that way instead of horizontally. If you talk to a Greek, they will likely think of it, talk to you about the dimension as a three-dimensional. So you talk about bigger, larger, fuller. You talk about those dimensions more than, so we're just this little block inside a big block. That's how their mind would tend to go. And they've found an indigenous community in Australia where they tend to think of time as the distance from east to west. And I don't know which one is past and which is future. I'm pointing north and south here, right? But they think of east to west, which, you know, it's almost biblical, right? He removes our sins as far as the east is from the west. We kind of like that. But what is Jesus' perspective on time? How does Jesus view time? Let's look at this verse again. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. A vapor. Last winter we had my sister and her 16-year-old son came and visited us from Haiti. And her son, my nephew, had been there for, I think, 6 years now since he'd been in Canada. So he would have been, I think, 9 or 10 when they moved to Haiti. And so we picked him up at the airport, and we drove home that night, and it was an enjoyable trip. It was late at night, and the things he saw in Toronto that he had totally forgot about existed in North America, it was intriguing, very, very intriguing. Things that me and you don't really think of. But then the next day, the rest of the family went off to school and to work and whatever, and so he was at home with me, and I needed to change the tires put the winter tires on a vehicle. Or was it a wheel bearing? I forget. I'm working on the vehicle anyways in our garage. And it's cold. It's one of the coldest days we'd had yet that fall. And he's there with me, helping me. But all once I heard him, like, sounds like a dog beside me. And I looked and, well, here he is just. He had forgotten all about seeing his breath in the winter, right? And you 10-year-olds here are grinning because, well, that's just part of everyday life, right? But he was 16 years old and experiencing this for the first time in a long time. But if that's your life, what happens when you do that? Can you grab it and put it back in? By the time you grab it, it's gone, right? By the time you try to retrieve that vapor, it's history. It's gone. Jesus says, what is your life? It is a vapor that appeareth for a little time, and then poof, it's gone. It's gone. Like that hourglass that runs out. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, we can turn to that.
2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1. For we know that our earthly house of this tabernacle, that if this earthly... For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, and house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. And again, if you look into that a little bit, the earthly tabernacle could be considered an earthly tent. We live in an earthly tent. If you enjoy camping, you go into a campground, a provincial campground, they get booked up way ahead, and you go there on a busy weekend, and the place is just crammed. I mean, you wonder sometimes, but then you look at Toronto and you think, okay, well, these people are getting out into the wild, away from everything, but there's so many of them, and so some of us try to go when there's not so many people there. But I find it interesting, you go into a campsite, and this fall we went to a campground and we spent most of a week there, and you know, you set up house. You live there for a week. You have whatever you need to exist. It was going to rain a few days, so we really set up a lot of tarps. It was almost like we had our own, and it's beautiful. Sit under a tarp in the rain, enjoy the rain if it's not too cold, a little bit of a campfire and a cup of coffee. It's a beautiful time. But then at the end of it, you clean it all up, and if you work together, it doesn't take that long, and everything's back in the pickup. And what's left? If you do it the way you're supposed to, there's no evidence. It's cleaned up. And the next camper comes and says, oh, this is neat. A spot right in the woods just cleared out for me. Nobody else was here before. You know better. But that's our perception as we get there, right? We live in an earthly tabernacle. We live in an earthly tent. Someday it will be gone. It will be cleaned up. And it will be used by somebody else. All the things that we thought were so neat about this tent are somebody else's privilege to enjoy. Now I'd like to turn back to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And you knew we were going here. We think about time. 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Well, do I have, here we are. Verse 19. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own? For ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. I want to think about that thought of being bought with a price. Are you aware that your time has been purchased? You are not your own. You are bought with a price. You know, I remember years ago, and I'm quite confident that this person won't hear this message, so I'm free to share. We had an employee working for us, and it just wasn't working. And other people were getting annoyed because on the days that she was there, they had to carry extra weight because, well, I'll tell you what worked really good on her. Her mouth worked good. That really worked well. And I have no problem with people visiting while they're working, but you caught what I said, while they're working. And she couldn't do both. She enjoyed talking, but she couldn't seem to work while she talked. And it kind of came to a head, and finally one day I sat her down. My wife and I think we're together, and we sat her down and we said, you know, what happened when we hired you, what actually happened is we made a contract with you. We bought your time for X number of dollars an hour. And during that hour, we expect you to give your best to this company. Because it's a contract. We bought your time. Now that sounds a little harsh, and I don't know if I've ever said that to anybody since, because it sounds, and I told her, I said, we can argue about the contract if you want. We could probably discuss whether or not we paid enough on our end for your time. That could be discussed. But that's not part of the conversation right now. If you want to be paid more, things are going to have to change, obviously, right? And so your time was purchased by somebody, and that's as an employee, and I've been an employee, I think, more than an employer. I'd have to think about that now. I used to always say that. But for many years, my time was purchased by somebody else. And I was required to use my best efforts for the person that I entered that contract with. If you have a employee that doesn't do that, you've got a problem. I remember another example where we had somebody that came in, and she was actually hired to be a manager, and that just proves my poor ability of figuring out who's who. But she came on a very busy day. We had a bit of a upheaval, and for some reason my wife and I were both working. That was when we had our second bakery, and we were both working there that day. It was the day before Thanksgiving. It was crazy. And she came in her first day on the job, and she was the boss. She told my wife and I what to do and where to go and how to do it. And needless to say, that didn't work very good. That is, I think, the only time that I used that 90-day clause. And she had to move on. What was paid for your time? You also, if you are a believer here this morning, you have also entered into a contract. 1 Peter 1, verse 18, "For as much as ye know that ye are not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as a lamb without blemish and without spot." You are bought with the most valuable. See, that employee I told you about, she could argue that we didn't exchange enough value for her time. You can't argue that. You have been purchased with the blood of the very Son of God. And what did God do that for? Why did God want you and I? What did He see in you as potential? I heard an illustration for this a while back, and I'm going to use it. It's not original with me, but it kind of, and I don't know if it's perfect. It isn't, but I'll use it anyways. Let's say you went out, and you know you needed a new car, a family vehicle. You really needed a new vehicle. You have to replace what you have, and you find something maybe at an auction, and the price is right, and boom, you bought it. All right, so you get this vehicle home, and it does look on the outside like the pictures you saw, but when you open the door, so much garbage and filth falls out, it's absolutely disgusting. The dog lived in there, and the mice did too. There's pop cans up almost to the windowsill. There's no way that you're going to drive this vehicle as a family. There's some serious work needed. Well, we paid money for it. We paid good money for this vehicle. Let's get to work. And you get the trash bags out, and you start cleaning this vehicle out. You start cleaning this vehicle out, and you get garbage and more garbage and more garbage. And when you're done, you start vacuuming and vacuuming, and the dust pours out, and you use your air nozzle, and you get more dust out. And finally, when it's all said and done, you get it usable. It's clean. And then you take all that garbage, every bag that you found, all that trash, all that dust, that dog hair, the mouse nest, and you dump it out on the kitchen table. And your wife comes home and says, honey, what in the world is going on? Whatever. What are you doing? Oh, I bought. Look what I bought. Look what I paid $5,000 for this. You what? You paid $5,000 for this garbage? Yeah. Aren't you excited? Well, no. See, God didn't buy you, he didn't spend his precious blood because he wants your sin. He didn't want the filth. He didn't want the mess. He bought you because he needed service. He needed your love. He wanted your commitment to him. He had to clean you up. He did clean you up. Praise the Lord, he cleaned you up. He took away that. He didn't dump it on the kitchen table. It disappeared. As far as the east is from the west, it's gone. But he wanted you for something more. He purchased you with his blood because he had a purpose for you. He has a plan for you. And so he buys back what he originally had. And then he gives you a gift. He gives back your time. And he says, now use it. And he allows you to decide how you're going to use your time for him. He paid for it. But now you get to decide, how am I going to use this time that God has given back to me? You do not deserve another minute. It's not like you're entitled to more time. It's a gift. It's a gift that God has given back to you. How are you going to use it? You know, so often we like to think, and this is beautiful, and you hear even Ray Comfort talks, is often used this in witnessing. He says, God has a beautiful plan for your life. And it's true. If you're here today and you're not walking in God's joy and his peace, I invite you. God has a beautiful plan for your life. God has a wonderful plan for you. He wants to clean you up. And he has a beautiful, wonderful plan for your life. We love verses like, for I know the thoughts that I think that I have towards you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you an expected end. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Those are promises in the Bible. Those are real. They are for you. Yes, indeed, God has a perfect plan for your life. It's a plan that's called death to self. And that's where we don't like it. That's where often we stop short. I thought of it while we were singing this morning in our number one in those books. There's a story ever new. I thought I heard Brother Isaac singing this behind me. I want to serve him more. And I asked him. He said, no. He said, I was singing, I will love him more. Because a lot of people want to love him more. That's great. But do you plan to serve him more? Love him more? But I challenge you, if you get a chance, go home tonight, today, whenever you get a chance this week, and sing that song. Take the word love out and put the word serve in there. Think about what Christ did, a story ever new. How he suffered on that tree. No love like that before. I want to serve him more. Now, love results in service. It does. Indeed it does. But God's plan for your life includes a recognition that God owns you. My time is not mine, it's God's. It's been redeemed. And one of the examples that I just happened to think of that kind of drove this home to me in 1 Timothy, we sometimes quote this verse without, maybe we even use it as a, but I've wondered sometimes how it actually works, and it kind of came clear to me this week. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8. says, if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. And I've wondered sometimes, how does that work? Like, that's super harsh. Worse than an infidel? How can that be? And I concluded, and I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts, maybe I'm wrong, but you know God has a wonderful plan for you, that's right. And part of that plan, if he has given you a household to take care of, his plan is that you spend your time to supply their needs. Not necessarily their wants, but their needs. Now, there is no saving grace in going out and supplying people's needs, even if they're under you. There's nothing that will save your soul in that act itself. But God had that plan for you, that you are going to take care of that household. And the reason that you're worse than an infidel if you don't do it is because you are not fulfilling God's plan for your life. It's not about the work that you're not doing. It's not about what's on the surface. It's because you are not fulfilling the plan that God has for your life. God has a wonderful plan for us, but it doesn't mean it's always the easy plan. It's not always the plan that feels the best. Wherefore he saith, awake thou that sleepest, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee life. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Redeeming there has a thought of rescuing from loss. Why? Because the days are evil. Redeeming the time, because the days are evil. We only have so much time. That hourglass has gone down a long ways already, and it doesn't stop. It just keeps going. It just keeps going, slowly, methodically. And we have a chance to redeem the time. So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Teach us to number our days. They are numbered. Are you numbering your days? That you may apply your heart unto wisdom. What is your life? As we think of time, we can't think of time without considering eternity. And it was interesting. I just punched in, and I try to refrain from using search engines while I'm studying too much because, well, today's world, you can just tell AI to print out everything you want. But I did put in Google something about the facts on time or something like that. And I read a few of the articles. BBC had one, an article, somebody had an editorial probably, on time, and it just made absolutely no sense. Because if you believe in the Big Bang Theory, and you don't want to admit that there's something happening after time, try to explain time. You cannot effectively, and none of us can explain time or eternity, but through the lens of eternity, we can start to at least get a glimpse of what time is. You sit down with a youth, a young married man, a middle-aged man, a young woman, young married woman, a middle-aged woman, and ask him this question. What is one thing you wish you had more of? What is one thing you wish you had more of? And you might get different answers. Maybe you'll hear money. Now I'm talking that not necessarily Christian people. I hope we would get different answers if we were talking Christians. But these are also things that affect us. Somebody might say money. Recognition. Pleasant experiences with family and friends. Fulfillment. You know what? I'm going to back up to that last one quickly while I think of it. A number of years ago, I was talking to a marketing director in relation to our bakery and just discussing what avenues, a little bit what what's the right way to go with marketing? She was from Stratford Tourism, and she was a professional, and it was free. And so I thought, well, I can sit down and learn a few things maybe. And but one of the things she said is, she said, today's society, we have so much stuff. And your tourists are coming out from Toronto, and they have stuff. They have no limit to access of stuff. What they want is an experience. And if you can sell them an experience, they'll be all over it. And so that's one of the things that people go after. They want more of experiences with family and friends. Fulfillment in life. There's different things that people would answer what they wish they had more of. But I guarantee you, you go to the side of a dying man, a younger man. Now, this might not apply to somebody that's quite a bit older and ready to meet the Lord, but a younger person that's on their deathbed, and you ask them, what do you want more of? What do you think their answer will be? Time. Time. They don't care about money. They don't care about reputation. They don't care about that new sofa. They don't care about that new car. They don't care about that new job. They want time. Why? Because eternity is coming. Eternity is coming, and it's an unknown, and they're not sure what's after this. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. We could read the whole chapter. We already read verse 1. Let's skip down to verse 9. Wherefore we labor. So he's talking about how we groan. We earnestly desire to be clothed upon in our new house. Let's just read from verse 2. We read verse 1. For this we groan, verse 2, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house, which is from heaven. If so be that being clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we that are in this tabernacle do groan, being burdened, that not for that we would be unclothed, but clothed upon, that mortality might be swallowed up of life. Now he that hath wrought us for the self same thing is God, who also hath given unto us the earnest of the Spirit. Therefore we are always confident, knowing that whilst we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Wherefore we labor, that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. Knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men, but we are made manifest unto God, and I trust also are made manifest in your conscience. And let's drop down to verse 14. For the love of Christ constraineth us, because we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead. If you want to do anything in life, if you want to have any success in life, whether it's whatever it might be, financially, relationship-wise, whatever it might be in life, there has to be a good motivation. You have to have, if you don't have a solid motivation for what you're doing, you will run out of steam. You might think that having the motivation of, I want to make lots of money, will take you down through a job that you don't really enjoy just because you want to make lots of money. Well, that's your motivator. You want to make lots of money. But more than likely, that motivation won't be enough to last very long. I've seen a lot of people go to Western Canada to make a lot of money, and they didn't do so well. You have to have a solid motivation for what you do in life. There are two motivators in here, in these verses, that I'd like to point out, and one is definitely greater than the other. The first one is in verse 9 and 10. Wherefore we labor, that whether present or absent, we may be accepted of him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body. That is a tremendous motivation. But before I go too deep into that, let's look at the next one in verse 14. For the love of Christ constraineth us. That is the greater motivation. If you do not have the love of Christ constraining you, you're not going to get very far in this Christian life. That is the greatest motivation. And this morning we sang about that in multiple songs. The love of Christ and the love of God will spur you into service for Him. It will indeed. And it is the greatest motivator. It is the one that we should focus on the most. We are not serving God out of fear. We are serving Him out of love. However, verse 9 and 10 certainly is a motivation as well. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. And this is talking to Christians. This is talking to you and I. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body. You are accountable for your time. You are. You will have to give account. You. Yes, the person beside you too. But you will stand by yourself. The judgment seat of God. And He will ask you. And you will be held responsible. I will be held responsible. And in this, I certainly saw my own weaknesses this week as I looked at that. Someday, that hourglass is going to be empty. It might be today. We don't know. You don't know. I don't know. Paul, in verse 2, he longs for that day. For this we groan. Why? Because he had a conscience void of offense. He was ready to meet the Lord. There was nothing between him and that judgment day. He was looking forward to standing there and giving an account for his life. And why? Not because he hadn't done some things that weren't right. Not because he had lived his life perfectly, I'm sure. But because of what he hadn't done for Christ was under the blood. And he had given account for it already through the blood of Christ. And so he was groaning for that time. He was ready to be delivered. Are you ready to be delivered? Are you waiting? Are you longing? Is that what your heart longs for? You know, if you're gone, if you've had to leave your spouse for any amount of time, and you know how good it is to be back together, and you can't wait. And maybe some of you haven't experienced that. You think of a really close friend that you've been away from for quite a while. And you just long to be together. Yes, you can do FaceTime. Yes, we can communicate in prayer with Christ. Yes, we have that option. But does your heart long and groan for that time when you can be together with Him? What is it that you think about that, oh, if I were to die tomorrow, there's a few things I should do before that? What comes to your mind? What's on your bucket list? The world talks about the bucket list. And sometimes we do too, maybe. What's on your bucket list? What are the things that you would like to do yet? What comes to your mind? You know, I remember, I thought as I was thinking about this, I thought of my mom. She passed away in 2016, and I remember the one day I was sitting by her bedside when it dawned on her, you know what? I'm never going to be able to wash dishes again. And it bothered her. That was an act of service that she did for us. She loved washing dishes. What's on your bucket list? Is it to serve more people? Is it to serve Christ by serving others? Or is it to serve yourself? I remember my uncle years ago came up to help my dad. He's lived in Mexico all his life, and he came up to help my dad for a summer. And I remember him commenting, I was pretty young at that time, but I did work with him some, and I remember him commenting, he said, I can't believe it. He said, you Canadians, you spend all summer getting ready for winter, and then you enjoy winter, and then you spend the next summer just getting ready for winter again. And there's some truth to that, isn't there? When you think about it, all summer long, you're busy raising vegetables, you're busy digging your water line in 4 or 5 feet deep in the ground, you're busy building a house that's well insulated, you're busy thinking about clothes for the winter, you're doing all these things, you're getting ready for winter, and then you have winter, and then you get ready for... Yeah, we do spend a lot of our time getting ready for winter, don't we? Can you imagine an immigrant coming to Canada? John, one of your Thai friends, coming to Canada in June. Oh, this is beautiful. This is like home. A little cooler, but it's fine. It's not so humid, maybe. I don't know exactly what their climate is like. And somebody tries to tell him, but remember, winter's coming. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Well, you should get a house. You can't live in that tent all winter. Yeah, we'll see. Imagine the shock when winter comes, right? Are you spending your life getting ready for eternity? It is coming. It is coming. Just like winter in Canada, it is coming. You might look at Job chapter 7. It was in my Bible earlier. There it is. Job chapter 7. Verse 6. Job says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is wind. Mine eyes shall no more see good. The eyes of him that has seen me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, and I am not. So you have a picture here of a person that has died. The eyes of him that shall see, that has seen me shall see me no more. And now he's dead. There's eyes looking upon him in the casket, and I am not. As the cloud is consumed and vanished away, so he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. And you look at that and you say, well, of course. Of course. Job was facing his own mortality. Everybody around him died. Everything else was taken from him. Of course he was facing his mortality. Of course he understood that that was a good time for self-reflection. Well, I thought of something today, this week, and I don't know if this is accurate. And if I'm not accurate here, I certainly open myself up to some of you brothers that have studied deeper than I have. Chapter 1 does say... God bragged to Satan. He said, have you seen my servant Job? There's no other man like him. He's perfect and upright. He fears God and eschews evil. Now, my question that entered my mind, was Job perfect? God said he was. But do you think Job was perfect in the sense that Jesus was? I don't see how that can be. I think he was perfect in the sense that his heart was right before God. He had a conscience void of offense. But maybe Job was a little attached to his things. Maybe Job was a little proud of his family. Maybe there were areas that God saw that, yes, he's perfect before me. His conscience is clear. He has done everything he can, but I want to take him to another level. I need to take him to another level. And he stripped some of this from him, and Job started to see who he actually was. You know, God is long-suffering, not willing that any should perish. But the question that I ask us this morning, how far will God have to go with you till he gets you to think like Job did? How far will God have to take you before you are willing to say, my life is like a vapor? Before you're willing to understand what you truly are before God? Yes, the Good Shepherd will go out on the high, on the mountains, and he will bring you back. But how far will he have to go? If there's something, if you are aware of any area in your life where you are not using God's time right, where God has been speaking to you, but you really don't want to do what he's asking of you, what will God have to do to stop you? What will God have to do to bring you to the place that Job was at? That's a question that's sobering for me. We have Jesus as our perfect example when we think of time. In John chapter 4, and we'll just briefly look at this. Jesus here, at the end of John chapter 4, he had been talking with a woman at the well, and then the woman left in verse 28, left her water pot, and went her way into the city. And verse 31, in the meantime, while his disciples prayed, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that ye know not of. Therefore said the disciples one to another, Hath any man brought him aught to eat? Jesus saith unto them, My meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. Say not ye there yet 4 months, and then cometh the harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white to harvest already. Here we have Jesus. He had been there for a long time, and his disciples went and got food. They show up at the where Jesus is, and he's busy talking to this lady, and finally this lady leaves. And they said, Master, now let's eat. And his reply is puzzling to them. He says, I have meat that you don't know about. And they said, well, did somebody bring him food while we were gone? What happened? What does Jesus mean that he has meat? He already ate? Then Jesus said, My meat is to do the will of him that sent me. Do you ever have a project that you are so engaged in, you're just enjoying it to the fullest, and you got to get it done, there's pressure, and you have a project, and you totally forget about the time, and you maybe your wife is gone, or maybe you're at home, your husband is gone to work, and all at once you realize it's 3 o'clock and I never ate lunch. How interested are you in the Lord's work? Jesus says, you know what? I have meat to do. I have work to do. He sent me. And you're saying, oh, yeah, but there's time. There's time. There's time. He says, no. Look at the fields right now. They're white to harvest. Jesus is saying to you, it's time to get to work. It's time to get to work. How serious are you? Are you willing to deny your flesh? Are you willing to deny the things that seem so important to you? Is it actually that exciting to you to work in my kingdom that you will deny your physical well-being in order to do it? Oh, you say that's way out there. That's for other people. Well, it is until you do it. And then you can experience the blessings that other people are. Things of time are the anesthesia of eternal perspective. Let me say that again. Things of time are the anesthesia of eternal perspective. They will lull you to sleep. The things of this world will lull you to sleep. You cannot help it. You ever try fighting anesthesia when your doctor wants to put you under? Good luck. When they say you're going under, unless they really don't know what they're doing. But generally, you're going to sleep. The things of time have a way of dulling us. Unless we have the power of Christ to combat that, we're going to sleep. They will dull the pain of eternity in your heart. And if you're here this morning and you haven't accepted Christ, and He's not your Lord and Savior, I beg with you, do not let the things of time dull your mind to the pain of eternity. There's only one thing that can remove that pain, and that is erecting with your eternal soul. Being willing to go to the foot of the cross, and then, like somebody said, not just going to the foot of the cross, but then climbing onto it for the rest of your life. Marine biologists, some time ago, I read this story, I don't know if it's how accurate, I didn't look into the details of it, but they did an experiment with a shark in a tank. They had a huge tank, and they had this shark in there, and they threw a bunch of bait fish into this tank, and guess what happened? The shark ate the fish, right? Just like that. That's what sharks are meant to do. They eat the food. So they put a solid glass partition in this tank. And they put the shark on one side, and they dropped the bait fish on this side, and that shark, boom, hit his head solid against that glass. They pulled the bait fish back out, they dropped it in again, boom. He knocked his head good and proper. And they kept doing it, and after a while, the shark started just, oh, he'd touch it, he'd feel it. Oh, no, he'd back off. After a while, it made no difference. The bait fish came in. And with time, they took the partition right out. And now the bait fish swam around the shark. And the shark didn't bother the fish at all. It was fine. He was used to it. You once were a shark. When you got saved, you did not doubt for a second that serving Jesus is what you would do the rest of your life. Not at all. Because of your recent experience that you had with Jesus, He was very real to you, and you fed on Him regularly. But then life happened. You noticed that the world around, when they would get aggressive in business, they did well. And so you tried it, and it works. So you started to lay aside some ministry to pursue this. You tried witnessing to your neighbor, and he rejected it. So you got a little more intense about our desire, a little less intense about your desire to do it in the future. You spent a lot of time in prayer for people, but in time you noticed that things are not changing as rapidly as you had hoped. And so you grew weary. You tried pouring your heart into your husband and family, dedicating your life to serving them in the home, but no one seemed to notice. So you backed off, and you began to live the fantasy life of others on social media. You tried to take time to dig deep into the Bible, but then you found reels. And now you swim about aimlessly in the pool, not aware of the rich food that swims around you. I'm here to tell you, the barrier is gone. The barrier can be gone immediately. You can feast again. All you have to do is decide that you want to. It's there for you. The barrier is imaginary. It doesn't exist. Feed on Him. Spend your time for Him. Give your body for Him. Do not waste another minute. Again, you are bought with a price, the precious blood of Jesus. Glorify God with every moment that He has given you. In all that, I want to say that God is not looking for superstars. You might feel a little bit like, wow, that's every minute of all my time. Look at all my inadequacies. God is only looking for dedication. He's looking for submission to His will. You know, inadequacy is the breeding ground for great things with God's power. Inadequacy is the breeding ground for great things with God's power. We say verses like, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities than that the power of Christ may rest upon me." But what if you really meant it? What if you really gave your weaknesses to God? What if you were willing? You know, we don't like to. We embrace our weaknesses. We tend to embrace our weaknesses. "Oh, my parents gave it to me. My circumstances led me to that. It was because of this and that person said this," and on and on, and we embrace our weaknesses. God is saying, "Give me your weaknesses and my strength will be made perfect in you." Perfect strength. Can you imagine that? We love to sing songs like, "Dead to the world would I be, O Father. Dead unto sin, alive unto thee. Crucify all the earthly within me. Emptied of sin and self would I be." Oh, we love to sing that song on Sunday mornings. But then Monday comes around, and we spend the rest of the week living for the world, living like the world. We play the world's songs in our cars. We are entertained by the same thing the world is entertained by: fast cars, big motors, excellent hockey players, fancy houses and decorations, beauty products, and nice clothes. We want God to do it for us. But are we willing to mortify, therefore, your members, to actually do it ourselves? And maybe, parents, you are thinking, "Oh, I hope my children are listening to this. I see I'm running out of time, but I'm going to read a poem." It was written by the son of Leonard Ravenhill as he sat by his dying father's bedside. And I want you to think about this, fathers, as I read this. Is this what your children would write about you if it was you in that deathbed? And before I read it, I would also say that just for you to think about, young people, Leonard Ravenhill began serving Christ at the age of 14, and by the age of 20, he was out on the streets preaching. An amazing, effective evangelism strategy that led thousands to Christ. So that was his life. "Tribute to a Godly Man. I knew a man who gave his life to see revival fire. He prayed by day, he prayed by night, to birth his one desire. He had but one obsession, to see a glorious bride, arrayed in spotless purity, brought to her bridegroom's side. His power in the pulpit was matched by very few, and yet he loved the closet, there with the God he knew. While others strove for man's applause, for fortune or for fame, he had but one ambition, to exalt his master's name. For 87 years he lived just for eternity, a man of faith and wisdom and true humility. He knew one day he'd have to stand before God's judgment seat, and so he ran to win the prize, his mission to complete. The fortune that he left behind was not in stocks or gold, but lives transformed and challenged, their stories yet untold. There is no greater privilege than this that I have had, knowing this great man of God and having him as dad." What will people say at your funeral? What is it that breaks our heart? What is it that really matters to you and I? Think about it. Dwell on that. What is your life? What is your life? The songwriter says, "Let my heart be broken with the things that break your heart, O Lord." You have the mind of Christ. Romans chapter 13, verse 11 to 14, I'll just read it. Knowing the time, it is now high time to wake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than we believed. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. In closing, I want to read one more short poem here. It's probably one that you're familiar with. Maybe you have read it or heard it. It's called The Dash by Linda Ellis. I read of a man who stood to speak at the funeral of a friend. He referred to the dates on the tombstone from the beginning to the end. He noted first came the date of the birth and spoke the following date with tears. He said what matters most of all was the dash between the years. For the dash represents all the time that they have spent on earth, and now only those who love them know what that little line is worth. For it matters not how much we own, the cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how we live and love and how we spend our dash. So think about this long and hard. Are there things you'd like to change? For you never know how much time is left that can still be rearranged. If we could just slow down enough to consider what's true and real and always try to understand the way other people feel and be less quick to anger and show appreciation more and love the people in our lives like we've never loved before, if we treat each other with respect and more often wear a smile, remembering that this special dash might only last a little while. So, when your eulogy is being read with your life's actions to rehash, would you be proud of the things they say about how you spent your dash? If you have time this week, look up a graveyard and go in there and meditate on the dash. Between the beginning date and the end date, meditate on that dash. How are you using that? Are you using that for Christ? Am I using that for Christ? I see a lot of ways that I can do better. Let's be faithful in using our time as He has called us, because He has redeemed it. He wants us to use it for Him. God bless.